Good evening and welcome to this week's edition of The Public Eye right here on 90.5 WICN, Jazz Plus from New England. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Listen online at wicn.org. I'm Al Vona, your host, and nice to have you with us this Sunday evening. My guest this week is author Kevin Smith. His new book entitled The Jailer's Reckoning, How Mass Incarceration is a Damaging America. And for the next half hour, we'll be talking with Kevin Smith about the implications, much of which is probably unknown to most Americans, the implications of mass incarceration here in this country, a fact that I myself learned in reading Kevin's book was that the United States incarcerates more people than any other nation on the planet, which I found very surprising. So for the next half hour, we'll be speaking with Kevin Smith about his book and the vital information, I think the important information, and most importantly, the interesting information regarding mass incarceration. Kevin, nice to have you with us.
Oh, thanks for the invitation, Al. I'm glad to be here.
This was I say this in a good way, an unusual book in that most people, I don't know, you know, everybody's different, but I think a lot of people wouldn't even touch the topic. Oh, God, we don't want to talk about crime. I mean, especially we just had an election. One of the major issues of the day leading up to the election was the fact that, you know, immigration and crime has risen and, you know, violent crime in this country and drugs and everything else. So most people were like, hey, enough of that stuff. But this is a little bit different. This is both a history, if you will, and vital information regarding mass incarceration here in this country and why we have such high numbers versus anyone else in the world. So I guess my first question to you would be, are we just likely to be a more crime-ridden country, or is that not necessarily the case?
I think the answer to the question is, there's not a single answer to the question. In some cases, we are a more violent country than certainly compared to other Western liberal democracies. But it's also our attitudes towards not just violent crime, but rule breaking in general. We're not only a country where more violent crime occurs, we're a country where there's a much more punitive attitude towards rule breakers. We're much more willing to lock people up for long periods of time for violating the law than comparable Western liberal democracies. So I don't think it's just one thing. I think it's, you know, partly crime rates, but it's also sort of like a cultural and political phenomenon in the United States.
The other thing, and I alluded to it, and I certainly don't want to go back and discuss the you know, the past election. You know, we I think most people have had enough of that. But what you do clearly mention in the book is the fact that we incarcerate so many people because politicians want to do something about the problem of crime. So I guess my question to you would be, is this politically motivated so that, you know, those in power, those, you know, both in Washington and even on the state level can say to their constituents, you know, look, we're doing everything we can. Look, we're opening new prisons. We're putting more people away than ever before so that your neighborhood, your neck of the woods will be nice and safe. Is this politically motivated, Kevin?
I think the short answer to that, Al, is yeah. But again, I think it's a little bit more nuanced than that. I don't think we can just put this on elected officials. I mean, elected officials behave in ways in which they think their constituents want them to behave. And, you know, the unfortunate fact is a lot of voters, their attitude toward people who commit crimes, especially violent crime, is lock them up. And, you know, legislators have an electoral incentive to respond to those attitudes, and they do. I mean, the bottom line is criminals do not have a very powerful constituency. And people who have, you know, punitive attitude toward criminals are a powerful constituency. And, you know, the electoral incentive for any legislator is to respond to that by saying, you know what, I hear you. I hear your voters. You're worried about violent crime. We're going to do something about it. And typically what we're going to do about it, we're going to become more punitive.
You know, one of the things I found interesting is that when I was a teenager, if you were caught, in those days they used to call it a nickel bag of marijuana, you'd be arrested. I'm not saying that you'd go to jail or prison, but you'd be arrested. We have decriminalized marijuana. And in fact, I thought if anything, and I want to get your sense on this, I thought if anything, we were actually getting a little soft on certain crimes, maybe misdemeanors rather than as you pointed out earlier, very violent crimes. So is there like a lessening of those types of crimes, but more heavy handedness when it comes to very violent crimes, murder, gang oriented offenses? Is there a category that has seen an increase in incarceration?
Yeah, I think that's correct. One of the big myths of why we lock up so many people is the war on drugs. And what I look at primarily in the book is incarceration at the state level, because this is where the vast majority of people incarcerated in the United States are sitting behind bars. It's in a state penitentiary. And if you look at the population of people who are incarcerated in state penitentiaries, only about 1 in 20 are there because of a conviction for drug possession. The vast majority of them, roughly two-thirds, are there because they've been convicted of a violent crime. And we've gotten much more punitive about how we respond to people who commit violent crimes. Now, that's not 100% true at the federal level. At the federal level, drug convictions are much more common. But those tend to be, charges of trafficking and much more serious sort of drug crimes. But down there at the state level, where most people are sitting behind bars, it's really not drugs that is driving the issue, except in sort of like a knock-on way. If there's violent turf battles amongst rival gangs because of drug distribution deals, that sort of thing. But what they're being convicted for is not for the drugs, it's for the violence.
Interesting. I want to take just a quick pause to remind listeners that you're tuned to 90.5 WICN, Jazz Plus for New England. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Listen online at WICN.org. I'm Al Voner, and this is The Public Eye. My guest this week is author and educator Kevin Smith. His new book is The Jailer's Reckoning, How Mass Incarceration is Damaging America. And we're talking about the implications of mass incarceration. Kevin, so true. I don't think anybody would argue with that it's a different type of crime today than perhaps 100 years ago. As you said, gang warfare, introduction of illicit drugs in this country. But surprisingly, I would have thought it would be the other way around. I thought, well, geez, Washington must be behind this full thrust. And therefore, they're putting more people in federal prison. So it's at the state levels that we're seeing more incarceration. But you've pointed out that many of those in state penitentiaries are there for violent crimes. Now, if we were sitting before a group of average Americans, they'd say, well, that's what they deserve. They crossed the line. They knew better. The law was very explicit. How do you address that?
Well, I think that's a perfectly legitimate attitude to have. And I think I'm like most Americans in the sense that, there are some people who repeatedly commit acts of violent predation, and I'd prefer that they were isolated from society and put behind bars. I think the border issue that I attack in the book, though, is we have locked up so many people that there are knock-on consequences that we haven't fully thought through. The consequences include everything from damaging our economy to eroding social cohesion and trust, to even altering election outcomes. And if we want to lock up this many people, I mean, that's okay. Democracy will respond to voters. And if voters have punitive attitudes and want people locked up, we're going to lock up a lot of people. But one of the points that I'm really trying to address and drive home in the book is, if we're going to do that, okay, but we need to think through the second and third order consequences because of what we're doing. Because a big issue, Al, is not just who's locked up. It is that we not only have the largest population of prisoners in the world, we have the largest population of ex-prisoners in the world. And those people are being released to the general population, you know, with pretty constrained social and economic opportunities, and that has consequences for all of us.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think a lot of people would say, okay, you know, he or she did their time. You know, they were convicted, they did their time, and now, you know, they're being released. What now? So with that said, based on your research, if an individual has been convicted and has served time for a crime in this country and then released, do you feel, again, based on your research, that there is there's really no safety net? Good luck to you. Have a good life. Hopefully we won't see you again. But there's a stigma attached to that, that they're probably less likely to be employed, probably haven't got the means to support themselves or find adequate housing. So that weighs on the public as well, right?
Yeah, that's correct. All else equal, if you have a prison record on your resume, that is associated with a 30% reduction in earnings over the lifetime. But it's not even just the difficulty in getting a job. You know, you're banned from certain jobs if you've got a felony record. It's not even just the simple economics of it that are kind of concerning, though. I mean, another fact is that if you serve time in prison, you're taking out of your community and your social relationships start to fray. Your relationships with your partner, with your family, with your children start to break down. And as those social relationships start to break down, if they're concentrated in a community, in other words, there's a lot of people who are sort of like going in and out of the criminal justice system, what you start to see is an erosion of social cohesion. I mean, the community itself starts to fall apart. The social scientist term for it is social capital. Essentially, people become less trustful, not just of each other, but also of the institutions. There's less support for schools. There's certainly less support for police, and community cohesion really, really suffers. And that's one of the issues that I don't think people have really thought through enough. It's not just an individual goes into jail, they come out with a felony record, then they have a hard time getting a job. And it's, you know, maybe there's some justification to an attitude of, well, so sad, too bad, you did the crime and this is the consequence. You know, if that is affecting an entire community, it affects you whether you've been convicted of a crime or not.
Yeah, some of the, and you will, you know, you touched upon it. We saw in the last decade a real pushback, if you will, on law enforcement. I think that's come around, and I think there's been a change in people's attitudes because they saw. And what I'm talking about is the lack of funding or the defunding, the call for defunding of law enforcement. Many people felt at first that the government and law enforcement was too heavy-handed. But then you look at cities, Chicago, New York, San Francisco, L.A., we're just pummeled with, street criminals breaking into stores, breaking into cars and homes. I guess what the part that's hard for most people, Kevin, and I want to get your sense on this, is that they say, okay, look, I'm willing to cut everybody a little slack. Okay, you made an error in life. You shouldn't have to pay for it for the rest of your life, unless it's been a real violent crime, and then that's a whole different story. So you've got a chance here to turn your life around. But when they see, when you back off, when you tell government, when you tell police or law enforcement to back off, and then we see this uptick in crime, it almost reinforces the notion that, yes, these people should be put away. We do need more prisons. We do need more jails. It seems that what I'm getting at is, it seems that there's a, you can easily get mixed up in all of this and not know what the clear path is, I guess is what I'm saying. So how do you differentiate it all?
Well, I wish I could clarify a clear path, in other words, a solution that addresses, you know, this incredibly disruptive and complex social problem, but I can't. You mentioned the police, Al. I mean, one of the things that social science makes clear is that one way to reduce violent crime is to put a heavy police presence in a community. And that is effective in suppressing violent crime. But essentially what you're doing is you're relying on an external paramilitary bureaucracy to keep social order. And you know, that's not good for social cohesion, and it's not good for social trust. I mean, the basic problem with incarceration and the basic problem with problems like violent crime is that ultimately there aren't solutions, there are trade-offs. And what trade-offs are we willing to make? And this is, you know, a central point that I'm trying to make in the book, is what are the trade-offs that we're willing to make in order to address this problem? One of the things that I talk about a lot in the book is what I call the tuna fish sandwich test. And I came up with this term, the tuna fish sandwich, from a guy called Larry Davids, who wandered into a Whole Foods in Austin, Texas, and stole a tuna fish sandwich and was sentenced for 70 years. He was incarcerated for 70 years for stealing a tuna fish sandwich.
70? 7-0.
7-0
years. Oh my God.
And this is because Texas is a three strike state, and that was his third strike. And so he's going to be locked up for 70 years. And even if he only serves half his sentence, the taxpayers of Texas are on the hook for millions of dollars to incarcerate him. And, you know, from the taxpayers' perspective, is it really worth paying millions of dollars for the theft of that tuna fish sandwich? And if the answer, after you think about it, is like, yes, I'm, you know, I want the world safe from lunch counter larceny. Let's lock him up. Okay, then you've made the, you've sort of like consciously and rationally thought this through. It's like, this is going to cost us a bunch of money, but it's worth it to us. But I think a lot of people will be like, locking somebody up for 70 years for stealing a tuna fish sandwich? That's nuts.
Yeah.
I mean, and that's just not a good deal for the taxpayer.
Yeah, that's...
And this is one of the things that I talk about in the book, is we need to sort of like apply that thinking, the tuna fish sandwich test, to a lot of what is happening with, you know, our patterns in mass incarceration.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think if you were sitting before a group of people, they would clearly say, Kevin, you're absolutely right for stealing a tuna fish sandwich. Are you kidding me? But you also shed light on something we haven't talked about, and that is, you know, somebody has to pay the fiddler on this. There's a bill to be paid, and it usually ends up on the backs of American taxpayers. It's not cheap to build prison systems. It's not cheap to hire staff, guards, and whatnot, and you know, keep this whole thing running, hopefully smoothly. So that's one of the implications that I want to get your sense on. And then the other one, as you were talking, I'm thinking, well, if we haven't got it down perfectly by now, who does? Is there a country? Is there a model that the U.S. should use? I'm not saying copy it verbatim, but at least get a sense of that this might be a novel way of approaching our problem. So two questions here. The financial impact on taxpayers, many of who are strapped already, through the economy, high prices, housing has gone crazy in this country. And then the other would be, is there a role model? Is there a country or a region of the world that does it right in terms of incarceration?
In answer to the first question, it is indeed incredibly expensive for the taxpayer to lock people up. There's a lot of variation from state to state, but in some states, you know, California, Washington, you're talking about, you know, somewhere between $70,000 and $100,000 a year to lock someone up. So in case you're spending more per inmate than you are per student in your K-12 schools. And if you look at what states, just states, not the federal government, just states spend on incarceration, it's the equivalent of the entire budget of the United States Marine Corps. So effectively, the taxpayers of the United States are paying the equivalent of a United States Marine Corps to lock up, you know, to lock up their own citizens. And in terms of, you know, who can the United States emulate? Is there a model out there that we can follow that would be, you know, a better, more efficient, less socially impactful way to deal with incarceration? Sure, there's some examples that we can look at overseas. We could look to our neighbors to the north, Canada. We could certainly look to liberal democracies in Europe, who are more likely to do things like have non-custodial sentences. They make a huge effort when people are incarcerated to make sure that they stay close to the community so they don't lose touch with family and their social networks. But I don't even think we have to look that far, Al. I mean, one of the things that I spend a lot of time talking about in the book is the huge variation among states. And some states are more like, you know, a Western European country in terms of their incarceration rates and how they treat criminals and handle the problem of ex-prisoners. And some states are more like Russia or China in their incarceration rates and how they treat ex-prisoners. So if you look at some of the states that do a better job of this, and I would include Massachusetts in this group, they're states that are, you know, less likely to have three strikes laws, for example. They are less likely to have, you know, really limited sentencing guidelines. You know, they allow judges a greater leeway to take into context. And, you know, it's an accumulation of these things that can actually sort of like not just reduce incarceration rates, but reduce the impact that incarceration has on society in general. So, you know, I don't think it's necessarily that we have to look to a model outside of the United States. I think we have models within the United States that other states can learn.
Yeah, good point. I'm glad to hear that, because I'm thinking, Jesus, does this entire country need an overhaul in terms of law enforcement and how we incarcerate, criminal activity? And I'm still trying to process in my mind the example that you used down in Texas over a sandwich. It's a little heavy-handed, and I'm all for, and I think most people would be. You don't want violent criminals ravaging our neighborhoods, threatening our families, our friends, and as you said, our social networks. But at the same token, I mean, $100,000 a year because you stole a sandwich, it just seems a little ridiculous. I guess some people, Kevin, and I know we don't have a lot of time, but I just want to throw this out there. Some people would say, well, it depends on where that state is. New Mexico, Arizona, Texas, just as an example, I visited down there, I've never lived there. People saying, well, you know, you don't have the issues that up north in the Northeast, you're dealing with cold every now and then and a few snowstorms. We're dealing with, an influx of illegal immigrants. We're dealing with violent crime down here. So I guess what I'm trying to say is if you were to gather a bunch of us from different regions of the country, we would all have our own opinions based on where we live and what's going on in our areas. And I think you're right. I think here in the Bay State, Massachusetts, I've always felt, safe, raised a family here. And I think most people would agree it's not perfect, but it's certainly, it's certainly a comfortable environment. You can always use better. We've got just a couple of minutes left. So in summing this all up, are you optimistic that, that this country will see the light, if you will, and work diligently to address the issues, and not putting people who steal tuna fish sandwiches away for life, and focus on real heinous violent crimes, and that we can be more equitable in terms of how we deliver criminal sentences.
The short answer is no, Al, because this is a political problem, and to have any solution at a legislative or political level, you know, one of the things that you absolutely need is you need public opinion to get on board. And public opinion, as you just sort of like hinted at, is fairly punitive towards criminals.
Mm-hmm. True. Very true. The book is, as I said, it's unique in that it points out something that in the back of people's minds, they're always thinking, crime was a big issue. The economy were two big issues in this election, and probably will be for many elections to come. Yes, I think people are also dismayed with political leadership in this country, both on the state, local state, and even on the federal level. So a lot of change has to be done. But the book is just a great way of opening people's eyes, getting a sense of what's really going on here. Who are we putting away? And why, and the, you know, the cost to, and as you pointed out, not only the financial cost, but the social impact that it has on a community and people's minds, thinking that, hey, my town was so safe 20, 30 years ago. It's not like that anymore. And I hear that quite a bit. Kevin Smith, thank you so much for joining us. Kevin, if the people want to just pose questions to you, get more information about your work, your research, we know the book, The Jailer's Reckoning, is widely available, but if they want to reach out to you directly, how might they do that?
The easiest way to do that would be through my website, which is easy to remember. It is Kevin B. Smith, KevinBSmith.com. And there's a lot of information about the book, but there's also a way to contact me that's right there on the website. So, and like my Twitter handle and everything is on the website too.
Good. I hope people, I always say that, I say that weekly, hope people reach out to our guests. They're always willing to talk and discuss, not only book authors, but any topic at all. So, Kevin's put it out there. So we'll leave it up to you, the listener, to follow through. The Public Eye is a production of WICN, and we always say weekly, if you have any questions or comments, I certainly welcome that, especially in regards to the Public Eye. You can reach me at Al Vona, V-U-O-N-A, at WICN.org. You can certainly always give us a call here at the station. Our main number is 508-752-0700. Again, I want to thank my guest, author Kevin Smith. The book is The Jailer's Reckoning, a great read. For the Public Eye, this is Al Vona. Thank you so much for tuning in.